This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your daily voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Washington Watch. Coming up on this Monday edition, as President Trump prepares for his first official trip to Asia, the war of words between the U.S. and North Korea has reached a level not seen since the end of the Cold War over 25 years ago. Dr. Bruce Bechtel, a retired Marine, former analyst at the Defense Intelligence Agency and author of North Korea and Regional Security in the Kim Jong-un Era, joins us with an analysis of the situation. And were Democrats playing a game of Russian roulette with their charge that there was collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russian government? New information suggests members of the Obama administration, Hillary Clinton, and the Democratic Party could become the target of the special investigation. John Solomon, Executive Vice President of The Hill, explains. And is America actually becoming more politically polarized? Dr. Stephen King, Professor of Government at Regent University, is here to discuss the answer. We'll also be taking your phone calls on that topic a little later here on Washington Watch. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, it's at TPerkins. All right, reports surfaced over the weekend that the U.S. Air Force is preparing to put nuclear-armed bombers back on 24-hour ready alert. This is a status not seen since the Cold War ended in 1991. Barksdale Air Force Base in my home state of Louisiana could once again see several B-52s parked on its concrete pads equipped with nuclear weapons and prepared to take off at a moment's notice. With this as the backdrop, President Trump is scheduled to make a five-nation Asian diplomatic tour the first of next month. Joining us now is Dr. Bruce Bechtel, a retired Marine, former senior intelligence analyst at the Department at the Defense Intelligence Agency, and his latest book is entitled North Korea and Regional Security in the Kim Jong-un Era. Bruce, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hi, Tony. Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad we were able to finally get together. It's been a couple missed tries.
Well, I'm glad as well. And, of course, events in the region of the world where you have your expertise seems to be heating up all the more. What do we make of this report that the United States is going to be prepared with these bombers standing by on a 24-hour alert?
Well, I think that's an important message for the North Koreans because, of course, they could have done this without releasing the information or leaking the information out so that the public knew it. Now it's out. It's obviously in a lot of press. The North Koreans know it. And it's clear to them that as the president makes his trip throughout Northeast Asia, that if the North Koreans are thinking of trying something, we have upgraded our deterrence status against them.
I mean, what do you make of this? I mean, we seem to you think it can't get any more, you know, tense, but we see the war words back and forth between the North Korean leader and, you know, movements by our president. I mean, how close are we to some type of confrontation?
Well, as you know, because you know, I followed your work over the years, North Korea and confrontation have been sort of two words that have gone together for a long time, really since before the agreed framework was even signed in 1994. They like to engage in brinkmanship and provocations, and we've seen that a lot over the years, including obviously in very recent times with the provocative behavior with their nuclear explosion of what appears to be a hydrogen bomb, very much so, 120 kilotons or more, and obviously their long-range missile test. So now here we are, and President Trump has decided to do something that really hasn't occurred since 2005 and most of 2006, and that's put real economic pressure on North Koreans. So please allow me to predict what's going to happen over the next few months. This pressure, which he's already engaging in, already putting pressure on African countries, on countries in the Middle East, on allies, to clamp down on these illicit activities and this illicit banking network that North Korea is using through many banks in Africa, Southeast Asia, et cetera, including many of our allies. This is coming coming to fruition. The financial squeeze on North Korea is actually occurring, much as it did in 2006. And what we can next expect is what the North Koreans did in 2006 was they popped a nuke and they fired a TAPO dom. So those are kind of OBE type things for us, you know, water over the bridge. So the North Koreans will have to do something much more fantastic or dynamic, if you will. And my guess is that sometime within the next year, as the economic pressure continues, as the Trump administration tightens the screws, the North Koreans are going to test launch an ICBM with a live nuclear weapon someplace in the Indian Ocean or the Pacific Ocean, that it won't hurt anybody. And then we will see definitive proof that the North Koreans have an ICBM with a nuclear weapon that can hit the United States. And that will be to shock and intimidate us. And the ball will then be in our court at that time, whether to keep the pressure up or let ourselves be intimidated by the North Koreans, as past administrations have done.
Well, let me ask you about that, Dr. Bechtel, because the current administration, some would say, is a little different than previous administrations here in the United States. How do you think they'll respond?
I'm hoping, and if anyone asks me, I'll tell them the same thing, and I'm glad you asked me. I'm hoping that they don't do what the Bush administration did, which is to say the Bush administration really had the North Koreans in a bad place. They really had them hurting, and their reaction to that was, okay, now we can get them back at the negotiating table and get them to get rid of their nukes. And what happened? The North Koreans ran circles around us again. They kept their nukes. In fact, they increased their program. So this time, one would hope that when we have the North Koreans in that bad place, and that's probably going to be a few months from now at least, that instead of just saying, okay, let's go back to talks, the Trump administration says, whoa. We're not going to go back to talks with you until you transparently show us dismantlement of your nuclear program and dismantlement of the platforms that would carry it. That is to say, those long-range ICBMs. And it will be then and only then that we will go back to the negotiating table with you and take the pressure off.
You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. Glad to have you with us on this Monday afternoon. Dr. Bruce Bechtel is my guest. He is a retired Marine, former senior intelligence analyst at the Defense Intelligence Agency, also a professor of political science at Angelo State University. Let me ask you this, Bruce. The economic situation in North Korea, they're pretty fragile. I mean, their economy, because there's everything's focused on the projects of Kim Jong-un, won't take a whole lot, will it, to really tighten the screws on them?
It won't. And what's important to remember is, as you recall, the sanctions against Iran, people were complaining about, you know, it's affecting the Iranian population, et cetera, et cetera. The population writ large isn't very important to Kim Jong-un and his inner circle and the elite, which is about 5,000 to 15,000 people. It's putting pressure on those people that's important. The guys that drive the Mercedes, the people who live in the nice apartments in Pyongyang, the people who control those three pillars of power, the security services, the party, and the military. Those are the people that pressure needs to be put on, and that's why I'm so focused on these financial activities and in inhibiting them. Because if you don't keep the generals living in high style, and you're not taking care of the scientists that are building your nuclear weapons for you, and you're not keeping the army well armed and you know, doing what it wants to do, pretty soon those guys will start turning on Kim Jong-un. And frankly, that's the situation that is what we are hoping for, because they need to feel real pressure in order to actually get rid of those nuclear programs or simply not survive. Because, as you said, the government in North Korea is far more susceptible to pressure than people lead on to. We know exactly what we need to do to put pressure on the regime. The Trump administration has started to do that, which nobody really wanted to do except for back in 2005, 2006. If they keep the pressure on, we know what's going to happen. They're going to react with very provocative behavior, and we just need to be strong enough to make sure we keep that pressure on until they make transparent moves, or frankly, until they implode.
All right, Professor, with that as a backdrop, the president next month, 1st of November, taking his first Asian tour, visiting five different countries. Is this kind of set the stage for tightening those screws, meeting with some of these other Asian leaders?
I think it really has. And that's a great question, by the way, Tony. I think that the Japanese are 100% on board with us with putting the screws to North Korea. I think the South Korean government and its president, Moon Jae-in, knows that regardless if they go along with us or not, we're going to do this because it needs to be done. But I think the South Korean government of Moon Jae-in is very, very hesitant to engage the North Koreans this way or go after them this way, because philosophically, the government of Moon Jae-in, much like the last liberal government, Noh Moo-hyun, their philosophy is if we give the North Koreans lots of good things and we engage them, eventually we'll move closer together and we can have peaceful unification. That's their philosophy. Remember, Moon Jae-in was Noh Moo-hyun's chief of staff when Noh Moo-hyun was president. So we're likely to see some pushback from them on that. But, you know, frankly, when the Bush administration did this back in 2005, 2006, so successfully, they didn't get a lot of support from the South Korean government and Noh Moo-hyun back then, but they were able to put real pressure on the North Koreans. So hopefully the Moon Jae-in government, after talks with President Trump, hopefully they'll be more cooperative than the type of actions we saw back in 2005 and 2006.
China's got to play a key role in this, too, because they're the major trading partner with North Korea.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, China is only a piece of the puzzle, but the biggest piece when it comes to, you know, putting this pressure on North Korea's illicit financial networks. Obviously, China is the closest to North Korea. They have the most banks. They're a very corrupt economy. 8% of their economy is illicit activities. So, I mean, the best way, in my view, to put real pressure on China is to make sure that we enforce the Patriot Act, Section 311, which talks about banks that support terrorist activities, and that we make sure that sanctions are applied to the smaller banks that North Korea is using, and hopefully a couple of bigger banks that North Korea is using in China. If we go after one or two banks that are very important banks, the rest are likely to follow because the Chinese will not want to see a collapse of their banking system.
Good point. Dr. Becker, one final question, 30 seconds. Should the president visit the DMZ when he's in South Korea?
I absolutely think he should visit the DMZ. I'm not the president, and I'm not on his security detail, but all of our past presidents, when they went to South Korea, visited the DMZ. So I think it's an important symbolic move by the president to visit the DMZ and show that we as Americans are strong and not afraid of the North Korean military presence there.
Bruce, thanks so much. Great to have you on. Tremendous insight. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Tony. Have a great night.
You do the same. Dr. Bruce Bechtel, professor of political science, Angelo State University. Find out more, go to the website, TonyPerkins.com. All right, there's still more Washington Watch to come. Could the tables be turning on the Russian investigation? John Solomon, executive vice president of The Hill, has an explosive report out in a new piece. We'll talk with him when we return here on Washington Watch. Don't go away.
We've gone from give me liberty or give me death to take care of me, please. What has happened to the American spirit? Our colleges were once bastions of free speech. Now they're bastions of speech codes. Our culture once rewarded independence. Now it rewards victimhood. Parents once taught their kids how to fend for themselves. Now any parent who tries may get a visit from the police. In a talk about his new book, Not a Daycare, Dr. Everett Piper, president of Oklahoma Wesleyan University, takes a hard look at what's happening around the country, including demands for safe spaces and trigger warnings at universities like Yale, Brandeis, and Oberlin, and digs in his heels against the sad and dangerous dumbing down of the American spirit. Dr. Piper has become known for his passionate defense of intellectual freedom, and he challenges the intolerant tolerance of today's academic community. Go to frc.org/speakers to watch. Again, that's frc.org/speakers. In a free country like ours, it's easy to forget that slavery still exists. Human beings are being trafficked and sold for sex against their will. Human trafficking is a horrifying scourge that continues to haunt America, particularly through the proliferation of illegal online transactions between traffickers and buyers. As part of the FRC Speaker Series, Congresswoman Ann Wagner discusses congressional anti-human trafficking initiatives and how the conservative community can best be engaged in combating this horrific crime. Congresswoman Wagner, who introduced highly anticipated legislation in April that allows states and victims to fight online sex trafficking, focuses on online sex trafficking via Backpage.com and other websites, and confronting the demand for sex trafficking in American culture. Find out more about Congresswoman Wagner's recent legislation and ways you can help stop trafficking at frc.org/speakers. Again, that is frc.org/speakers.
Is being right enough to win an election? Many tend to believe that being right, in the sense of being factually correct, is sufficient to win in politics. Unfortunately, political history proves otherwise. The candidate who organizes and communicates the best will beat the opposition, no matter how right the other side is. Christians who are running for public office have a moral obligation to study and learn how to win. They must discover the real nature of politics. Robert Arnakis knows how to win. As Senior Director for the Leadership Institute, the nation's premier public policy training organization, he has 15 years of grassroots organizing, campaign, fundraising, and communications experience, and has established himself as one of the country's top political trainers. Here, Mr. Arnakis discusses the real nature of politics and how to overcome the odds to win an election. Go to frc.org/speakers to view this timely discussion.
Listening to Washington Watch, I'm Tony Perkins, the website tonyperkins.com. All right, for months now, since the election, we've been hearing about Russia and collusion with the Trump campaign and, everything's Russia. Well, a new investigative report finds that before the Obama administration approved a controversial deal back in 2010, it's a long time ago, giving Moscow control of a large swath of American uranium, the FBI had gathered substantial evidence that Russian nuclear industry officials were engaged in bribery, kickbacks, extortion, and money laundering. The report also shows that the influence peddling was designed to grow Vladimir Putin's atomic energy business inside the United States. This is according to government documents and interviews. And congressional officials were not brought into the loop of all the details of these criminal investigations. With us now is John Solomon. He's Executive Vice President of The Hill, and he has written a very explosive article covering the details. John, welcome to Washington Watch.
Good to be with you, Tony.
Well, John, first off, I'm not quite sure where to start with this, because there's so much in your article. Just give our listeners a sense of what this information means.
Sure. So I think when you boil it down, what it really means is that 7 years before Russia ever tried to meddle in the 2016 election with Facebook ads and Twitter ads, they were trying to meddle with our nuclear security. They had set up a bribery ring here in the United States. They sent an official over to lead it, and he, while trying to win new business from the Obama administration, compromised several U.S. contractors, the most serious of them being the company that moved all of the uranium that Russia shipped into the United States. That's a very sensitive job. If you have access to uranium, people on the black market, bad guys would like to get access to you. So the Russians had compromised that person by entering into a bribery kickback scheme, over $2 million went back and forth between the two sides. The FBI knew this in 2009, but in 2010, despite the evidence of Russian nuclear bribery, the Obama administration went ahead and authorized the sale of 20% of America's uranium supply to the Russian company Rosatom, whose very employee was engaged in the bribery.
This information, even within our own government, as this investigation was going on, even officials within the FBI were not completely aware of this. Was there some effort to kind of keep a lid on this?
That's one of the open questions. We know for sure that even though the FBI had more than enough evidence by early 2010 to bring criminal charges, the Justice Department, which finally makes prosecution decisions, waited nearly four more years before they brought any prosecution. And in those two windows, between 2010 when they had the evidence and 2014 when they finally started to roll up and arrest people, the Obama administration made a series of very favorable decisions to the Russian nuclear industry. First, they approved the sale of Uranium One, giving 20% control of the uranium supply to Russia. They gave permission for Russia to sell billions of more commercial nuclear fuel to the United States. That was a big win for Moscow. And then Hillary Clinton also tried to help set up a Silicon Valley type deal near Moscow, sending American executives over to get Russia started on that project. And so they were getting a lot of favorable treatment while their own executive here in town was doing some really bad things. And I think the other thing that we forget about this part of the story is that Bill and Hillary Clinton were cashing in during this time. So Bill Clinton goes to Russia right in the middle of these decisions, and he gets a $500,000 payday for a single speech. That's pretty good work. And then their foundation got millions of dollars in support from people that were interested in these various nuclear deals that the Obama administration were approving.
So where does that stand in terms of looking at the connections between the monies going into their foundation, the monies that they received, as you mentioned, Bill Clinton's speech? How do we know if this was a quid pro quo or not?
That's a great question. And as you know, President Trump raised this issue frequently during the 2016 election, the old crooked Hillary line that he would use on the campaign trail. There is some pretty substantial evidence that the Senate Judiciary Committee under Chuck Grassley, and I believe tomorrow we'll find out that the House Intelligence Committee, are both launching full-scale investigations to find out if there was a quid and a pro and in between here. And I think you're going to learn that there was an undercover informant that helped the FBI throughout this investigation. He has never spoken publicly, and I believe efforts are underway to get him to tell Congress what he witnessed. One of the things his lawyer told us in a story that's on our site right now that we published today is that he witnessed conversations in which the Russians were describing how they were going to ingratiate themselves and gain influence with the Clintons. Another piece of the puzzle story that we have just today, it just broke today, is that the FBI detected in 2009 and 2010 that a Russian spy was getting close to Mrs. Clinton through a Democratic donor. And she had been tasked. She was posing as an American accountant, though she was a Russian. She got into Mrs. Clinton's inner circle through the form of a big donor. And the FBI was so worried they were about to get close to the Clintons and compromise them that they arrested her and deported her. And so we can see all these efforts to try by Russia to get inside the Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton world. And I think these committees will have a chance to answer whether anything was a quid pro quo or not.
So, John, we're almost out of time here, but John Solomon, is there a chance here that those that were salivating, hoping that this show that there was some connection between Trump and the Russians, that the tables could turn here?
There's definitely the danger of a boomerang here, which is, before you can almost look at the 2009-10 period as a pretext to what happened in 2016, except in 2009 and 10, the targets were Democrats, particularly Mrs. Clinton. And I think you're going to hear a lot more about this story over the next month.
Fascinating. Fascinating. Great article. John Solomon, thanks so much for joining us today. John Solomon, Executive Vice President of The Hill. You can read his article. Go to TonyPerkins.com. Russia, the Democrats playing a game of Russian roulette. I mean, think about that. They were trying to make it look as if Trump was colluding, the campaign was colluding with Russians to tilt the outcome of the election. And now with all this digging into Russia, finding out a lot more about the Clintons, Obama administration and the Democrats and how they've potentially jeopardized national security. All right. We're going to keep an eye on that story. All right. Coming up next, a new study finds the political divide is widening. Dr. Stephen King, a political scientist at Regent University, will help us take a look at a report from Pew Research. That's coming up next here on Washington Watch. Don't go away.
Every day, the Christian worldview is increasingly being pushed out of the public square and out of public policy. Family Research Council is an organization that works to advance faith, family, and freedom in public policy and culture from a Christian worldview. We want you to know that we are your advocate in our nation's capital. To learn more about FRC, go to frc.org and follow us on social media to receive our action alerts and stay up to date on the latest news.
Is being right enough to win an election? Political history proves otherwise. The candidate who organizes and communicates the best will beat the opposition, no matter how right the other side is. Christians who are running for public office have a moral obligation to study and learn how to win. They must discover the real nature of politics. Robert Ornakis is one of the country's top political trainers. Hear him discuss the real nature of politics and how to overcome the odds to win an election at frc.org/speakers.
The Family Research Council had the pleasure of hosting Dr. Michael Paulson to speak about how Christians can respond to arguments against religious liberty. Dr. Paulson argues that religion is different and deems exemptions within the law. A religious person believes in God, and God's sovereignty requires complete devotion, whereas government only requires allegiance and civil duties. The Constitution itself treats religion differently, giving America religious liberty and the freedom to exercise. Visit frc.org/university to hear more about this issue.
If you had to make a law, where would you start? America's founding fathers determined law from a fixed source, God, but culture has shifted the focus to man's self-determined law. If truth is no longer determined by God, it becomes subjective and open to interpretation. In an incisive new paper, Peter Johnston traces the origins of these dangerous trends in American law and the importance of staying true to our founding principles. To view FRC's new publication, go to frc.org/decay.
I'm Tony Perkins, and this is Washington Watch, and the website is tonyperkins.com. If you're on Twitter, it's at T Perkins. All right, a new poll released by Pew Research finds fewer Americans hold a mix of conservative and liberal views, meaning very few people straddling the fence. The study claims there is less overlap in the political values of Republicans and Democrats than there has been in the past. Here to discuss this polarization is Dr. Stephen King, chair of the Department of Government, History, and Criminal Justice at Regents University. Dr. King, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you very much, Tony.
All right, what is what's driving this political divide?
I think there are two things. First, we are finding, I would argue, tectonic cultural shifts in society today. We've seen these kinds of shifts all along, shifts along social issues, political issues, economic issues, but they seem to be exacerbated in this very, very divisive society that we live in. And this divisiveness is not just in the politics, but it certainly is manifest there. I think it's divided within our social sphere, within our economic sphere, within our legal sphere. We just seemingly are lacking any kind of ability or willingness to compromise. I think there's a second thing, and this might be even more troubling, and that is what I would refer to as sort of an institutional lack of cohesiveness, sometimes referred to as sort of the deinstitutionalization of institutions. And what do I mean by that? I simply mean that our institutions, by nature, are supposed to be conservative. Conservative in the sense of retaining the status quo, conserve those values for society.
Right.
But what happens in a society when those institutions no longer become conservative in the sense of saying stability, security? What happens when a executive order can essentially overturn some kind of a piece of legislation or a piece of bureaucratic rule or regulation from the previous administration, and then the succeeding administration can do the same. Or the same can be said for a court case in which a decision by five justices or judges can overturn a legislative document by the legislature itself. And so I think that this lack of cohesiveness, this sort of what I call the deinstitutionalization of the institutional of the institutions, is leading to this. And it reminds me of that scripture in Psalm where it says, if the foundations be destroyed, what can the righteous do? And when the foundations, such as institutions, are becoming less able to deal with these kinds of changes, then something has to fill that gap. And I think what's filling that gap is just more division. And more division leads to more rhetoric, invective rhetoric, and it leads to more social instability, and it leads to more challenges to those very institutions that we've had in the past.
So the institutions, what they provide is stability, as you pointed out, and when society loses those, it loses its equilibrium. And something has to happen to bring that back into line. Historically, what are the types of things that we see that brings a society? I mean, you can't forever maintain this type of division. I mean, something has to happen.
No, you can't. I think one thing we have to see it is there's got to be some sort of transformational, I want to say thing, but transformational action that has to take place, or something has to happen within society that needs to bring society into
together.
An understanding of this kinds of shifts that are taking place. I don't believe it's going to happen at the political level. Or even if it does, it's not going to have the kind of transformational impact that needs. We need to have it at the, what I refer to as the lower levels of society. We need to happen in the communities. It needs to happen in the churches. It needs to happen in the local economic development spheres. It needs to happen within para church and nonprofit organizations. It needs to happen in where the families are living and working together. The transformation of society needs to take place at, you can call it the lower levels or the subnational levels, the state and the local levels. This is where society has to have productive change. And I think you've seen that kind of change in historical periods throughout our era, dating all the way back to the beginning of the Revolutionary and colonial time.
Well, Dr. King, I mean, part of that in part describes like a revival, a spiritual awakening.
Oh, absolutely. And we've seen those taking place at the turn of the 19th century and the turn of the 20th century. So, yes, absolutely. And I think those kinds of events, those kinds of transformations, if we want to use the spiritual term revival, those have to take place when we have committed individuals around a particular value, the value being God is who he says he is, the scriptures invoke who he says he is, and we need to believe who he says he is and what he can do, and that those foundations that we have, those economic, political, legal, cultural, familia, all those kinds of institutions that I think have come to that point where I said before, we need to be much more reliant upon him than we've ever been in the past.
Dr. King, we're up against a break. Can you stick around for a couple of minutes?
Sure, will do.
Because I want to ask you another question on the other side of this break. I hope your schedule will allow. If you can, I'd love for you to stick around, because I want to ask you, I want to finish this conversation with you, because I think it's fascinating. Because, folks, I do believe we're at a point where I don't recall in my lifetime ever seeing the nation so divided. It only seems to be intensifying. And so we're going to talk about what will it take to change it. Something's got to break at some point in time. So we're going to finish our conversation with Dr. Stephen King on the other side of the break, and then we're going to be taking your phone calls as well here on Washington Watch. What do you think? Is America a divided nation? We're going to talk about that when we come back. Don't go away.
Are you worried about the moral direction of America? Do you feel powerless to make a difference? Family Research Council is an organization that works to advance faith, family, and freedom in public policy and culture from a Christian worldview. Established in 1983 in Washington, D.C., Family Research Council conducts research, develops policy, drafts legislation, and educates policymakers, pastors, and the grassroots. It testifies before Congress and shapes public debate through the media and internet. Every day, the Christian worldview is increasingly being pushed out of the public square and out of public policy. We want you to know that we are your advocate in our nation's capital. To learn more about Family Research Council, please visit us at frc.org and follow us on social media to receive our action alerts and stay up to date on the latest news. Again, that's frc.org.
In a free country like ours, it's easy to forget that slavery still exists. Human beings are being trafficked and sold for sex against their will. Human trafficking is a horrifying scourge that continues to haunt America, particularly through the proliferation of illegal online transactions between traffickers and buyers. As part of the FRC Speaker Series, Congresswoman Ann Wagner discusses congressional anti-human trafficking initiatives and how the conservative community can best be engaged in combating this horrific crime. Congresswoman Wagner, who introduced highly anticipated legislation in April that allows states and victims to fight online sex trafficking, focuses on online sex trafficking via Backpage.com and other websites, and confronting the demand for sex trafficking in American culture. Find out more about Congresswoman Wagner's recent legislation and ways you can help stop trafficking at frc.org/speakers. Again, that is frc.org/speakers.
If you had to make a law, where would you start? America's founding fathers determined law from a fixed source, God. But culture has shifted the focus to man's self-determined law. If truth is no longer determined by God, it becomes subjective and open to interpretation. In an incisive new paper, Peter Johnston traces the origins of these dangerous trends in American law and the importance of staying true to our founding principles. To view FRC's new publication, go to frc.org/decay.
The Family Research Council had the pleasure of hosting Dr. Michael Paulson to speak about how Christians can respond to arguments against religious liberty. Dr. Paulson argues that religion is different and deems exemptions within the law. A religious person believes in God, and God's sovereignty requires complete devotion, whereas government only requires allegiance and civil duties. The Constitution itself treats religion differently, giving America religious liberty and the freedom to exercise. Visit frc.org/university to hear more about this issue.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins, the website, tonyperkins.com. All right, a Pew Research Center poll study out shows that there's a continuation of a trend documented in the center's 2004 study of political polarization in the American public. It's only intensifying. Republicans and Democrats, according to the survey, the study, are now further apart ideologically than at any point in more than two decades. Joining us now is Dr. Stephen King, professor of government at Regents. Professor, we're talking about that you have to bring society back. There's this equilibrium. There's got to be a release somehow. We can't stay this divided.
Right.
Arnold Toynbee, a historian, would often write in his writings of civilizations, would say that oftentimes it was the external threat that would cause a society to use their creative energy to preserve. It could, you know, we're living in a very volatile time. Could that be a trigger that could bring America together again?
Well, it's distinctly possible, Tony. You would think with the number of different challenges around the world today, the least of which is in North Korea, immigration issues, ISIS issues, Syria in itself. There are so many flashpoints that are there that you would think that at some point we would do what we call in political science rally around the flag. That is, we say we would have a unification around certain values, values of defense and security, values of homeland, etc. But I don't even see that happening.
No, we're taking the knee at the national anthem.
Well, exactly. So what does that say to us? That says to us that which the flag stands for, that which the anthem was written to stand for, is no longer preeminent, is no longer important, is no longer looked upon as a, shall I say, a stabilizing factor or value within society.
Well, isn't that a very dangerous place to be?
Well, it can be. One could argue that that's free speech. One could argue that that's my civil right, just as the many NFL players are kneeling to, you know, make the argument that Colin Kaepernick made when he said, you know, I'm only doing this because I want to make an argument for or bring about this issue that relates to police brutality against African-American males largely. Well, yes, but is that issue as important or more important than our standing for the values that allow us to even make that kind of a statement and go forward? And we seem to have gotten what I would say the forum through which that is being developed in front of several thousand, if not millions of people each week. Is that the correct forum to do that? I don't think anybody takes away from the NFL football players or Colin Kaepernick or anybody else from making that kind of an argument, but is that the forum to do it? And when you do it in that forum and you do it in the way that it's being done, what does that say to the issue of saluting or not saluting, standing or not standing before the flag? It tells us that those values that those emblems stand for, those symbols stand for, are just not as endearing as they once were.
So, Dr. King, that would suggest then the external threat might not be what will bring us together. In fact, it could further divide us.
It could further divide us. I mean, look what's happening in Europe with illegal immigration. There's no border safe, practically, that's allowing for it. And we certainly don't want to look like England, where it's porous. We want to hold to some sort of standard, but yet even then, I'm not sure what that standard is. Many people would argue, why don't we just uphold the laws that we have on illegal immigration that are currently there? But the last administration opted not to do that. The current administration says it wants to do that, but then up the ante by building the fence and having Mexico pay for it. That has a, you know, that rings true with a certain group of individuals within our society that helped elect President Trump, but that causes division. I mean,
right.
Distinct division, almost division to the point where we see what was taking place in Berkeley and the issues dealing with free speech on campuses, et cetera. Well, we've seen this happen before, Tony. You remember the 1960s, and you know what happened during those times, and particularly during the 68 Democratic Convention and the riots that were taking place in Chicago at the time. But there just seems to have something else behind this.
That seemed more isolated, though. I mean, it seemed to be a segment where the division today is more broad in our society as a whole.
It does seem to be more pervasive. It seems to be taking place in so many different areas within our culture, within our societies. But I would go back to my earlier statement where I would say, if we're going to find any kind of relief, if that's the right way of putting that, if we're going to find any kind of solutions, is probably a better way of saying it, then it's going to have to take place at the lower levels, for the lack of a better term, of society. I mean, we have got to see the change taking place in the marriages, in the families,
right,
in the communities, in the educational institutions, and moving your way forward in that way.
Well,
I don't think
it would have to go back to your other point about the deinstitutionalizing of institutions. There's no trust in the higher up, so it can't come from above. It's got to come from beneath.
That's very true. Despite the fact that we see single-digit trust confidence levels in national government, and particularly Congress, if you were to look at the same numbers for state legislative bodies or even for city councils, et cetera, they are much higher. They're in the mid to upper double percentage brackets, and that's because people know their representatives,
right,
much more,
right,
than they know others, and therefore they can also take that and bring it over to the larger institution itself and say that I believe I can make an impact, or I can have inroads, or I can at least understand what is going on better because I can make the trek to the county seat, or I can make the trek to the state capitol, and I can have some input in that way. But that doesn't take place at the national level. And that has been a reoccurring factor over the last several years, even the last several decades. We've been seeing that trust and confidence in our national institutions eroding. whereas at our local and state level, they tend to be maintaining, although we have seen some of that, i.e., our first responders. Look what has been happening towards our police officers,
right,
primarily,
right.
Not so much our firefighters, but our police officers and other emergency law enforcement personnel.
Well, every institution has been under attack, and I mean, it's losing its ground, its footing. And so I think it goes back to that organic of the family. It goes back to the community. And I think we come back full circle, and that is really the only thing I see that could heal the divide in America would be that spiritual awakening, a move.
And the only way to instigate that, Tony, as you and I well know, and that is through heartfelt prayer of the Christians in society, and particularly in the United States, who desire to see that kind of movement and that kind of a transformation within society itself.
Well, you have given us something to pray about, Dr. King. Thanks so much for being with us today.
You're very welcome, Tony. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Dr. Stephen King, fascinating conversation. To find out more about Dr. King, go to the website, tonyperkins.com. 866-372-7234, 866-372-7234. To get on this conversation about America's growing divide, and you know what, we kind of distilled it down. The only thing that really can bring back the, well, bridge the divide, it's not going to be through government. That only seems to provide fuel to the angst. And even, it's not going to be institutional. There's the lack of trust in the church as an institution. It's going to have to come from individual believers who are living out their faith in a real and authentic way and sharing their faith with people who are looking for answers and who are desperately looking for peace and security in the midst of the turmoil. And guess what, folks? If you're a follower of Jesus Christ, you got the answers. If there was ever a time for us to share our faith, it's now. Really, the future of America depends on it. 866-372-7234. Let's go to Georgia, where Donald is on the line. Donald, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hey, thank you for allowing me to be on your radio show. My question is, yeah, thank you. My question is, the flag represents values that we're supposed to live up to. Am I correct?
They represent, it represents America, and America it's warts and all. I mean, America is not a perfect country.
Right. Now, doesn't matter if you're perfect or not. You attempt to do what you can do best. Do best you can, excuse me. Now,
correct,
if you're not doing your best, you're not even, it was show. So when he said that the guys were kneeling during the anthem and it was, you know, that was not the place to do it, okay, well, fine. Well, the problem was, or is, that we don't want to talk about it, not in the church. We don't see churches out there marching against these extreme hate groups for rights for others, because Christ did that. He spoke against racism, and the church is not doing it. You should have been talking about that a long time ago in church. You have been tone deaf, so we had to put it in your face. So when you're going to start talking about it, when you're going to start living up to the values, the American values that flag represent, and the Christian values. When are we going to do that?
Well, I agree that the conversation should be in the church, and I would suggest that it is to a large degree in our mm-hmm. churches. I mean, increasingly, I've been a part of a lot of integrated churches. And can the church do more? Absolutely. I think the church has to be engaged in speaking to all of these cultural issues. Donald, I think you're correct in that we need to... for instance, let's take the issue of the family, which is at the foundation of a civil society is the family and the structure of the family. Society's not going to be any stronger than the family. Churches really don't want to talk about divorce, cohabitation. I mean, those are sensitive issues. talking about human sexuality and that sex is designed by God to be confined within a marriage relationship of a man and a woman. I mean, those things need to be spoken about as well. So all of those issues, I don't disagree with you, Donald. I think if the church did a better job, we wouldn't see as much of this spilling over into society as a whole. But that brings me back to the point that Dr. King was talking about. I think that the one thing that can bridge, and I think we're at a very, very dangerous point when you see the nation so divided, and as we pointed out, that if those external threats, which exist, become more prominent and pronounced, we may be too far divided to come together to stand against the external threats. Which, going back to Arnold Toynbee, a historian who wrote back in the 50s, analyzing all of the previous civilizations and what brought their downfall, and new life could be given to a civilization when there were these external threats. I think we saw a little of that after 9/11. But then we've seen this, as Dr. King's discussion of the deinstitutionalization of the institutions, it's going to be hard for people to rally behind their government. Donald, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Bill in Georgia. Bill, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hey, Mr. Tony, we met in Louisiana during the floods over at a church, and I came down with my friend Clifton, and we brought barbecue.
Yes, absolutely. It was great barbecue. I enjoyed it.
Yes, and we brought 18-wheeler full of supplies there for Louisiana. And it kind of touches base with my point that I think we have to wake up in the mornings and look in the mirror, and we have to ask ourselves a question. And that question is, how am I going to change someone's life today? And to serve one another. I think we're looking in this, looking in the America mirror and asking, well, what can I get out of this? And I think we have to go back to serving one another, regardless of who the person is we're serving. But to wake up and decide, I've got to help change lives, and that life will change might be our own. And I think service to one another is just a part of what can help bring our country back together. And, of course, that is found in the love of Jesus Christ. And
Excellent point, Bill. You're absolutely correct. And I was just thinking of that from in John chapter 13, Jesus talking about loving one another. And the standard of love is Jesus. And it was that of the heart of a servant. Great question that we should ask ourselves each morning. How can I make a difference? Who can I serve today? Bill, thanks so much. And, thanks so much for the barbecue. That was great. And I hope it doesn't take another flood to eat more barbecue. But thanks so much for listening and calling in. Well, folks, we're up against the break. And we'll continue this conversation. I know the phone lines are full. We're not going to be able to get to any more of the phone calls. But I think we're going to continue this conversation because I think we may have stumbled upon something. And I think it's a great question we should ask ourselves in the morning. How can I serve someone today so that I might be a part of bridging the divide in America? Something to think about. All right, folks, until next time, I leave you with the encouraging words of the Apostle Paul found in Ephesians 6, where he says, when you've done everything you can do, when you've prayed, when you've prepared, and when you've taken your stand, by all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.